ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Welcome to the Bible and Archaeology, a study into biblical archaeology and history. I am E. Raymond Capt, Bible archaeologist and research historian. Before the middle of the 19th century, the Bible was the only source for the Bible narratives before 550 B.C. Many believed the Old Testament, before Abraham, was a series of ancient fables, not confirmed by historical or archaeological evidence. However, archaeology has since made many discoveries that have shed light on the Scriptures. Numerous critics of the Bible boasted of using so-called scientific methods, they claimed, to challenge the historical and geographical accuracy of the Scriptures. However, since the middle of the 19th century, archaeologists excavating in the Bible lands have produced the evidence confirming the dependability of the Bible, disproving the accusations made against the Scriptures, historically, geographical, and cultural. An Egyptian peasant working in her garden on the Isle of Elephantine digs up some old parchments. They turn out to be from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, revealing significant data on that period of Israel's history. A 24-year-old Italian archaeologist excavating a mound in Syria, after 10 fruitless years, uncovers the capital city of Ebla with an ancient library of 20,000 tablets and fragments dating back to the 3rd millennium B.C. Many biblical names, only known in biblical narratives before, are described exactly as they are in the Scriptures. For example, Sodom and Gomorrah, once considered more legendary than real. Discoveries made in Egypt and Sinai have cast new light on the period of Israel's sojourn in Egypt and the Exodus. Critics who challenge the reliability of the Book of Daniel have been amazed to discover how wrong they were. Nebuchadnezzar emerges from the archaeological dust as a great builder and king, just as portrayed in the Book of Daniel. Belshazzar has been confirmed as truly a king of Babylon, as vice-regent with his father, Nabonidus, at the time of the fall of the city, contrary to what the critics had claimed. The uncovering of these buried treasures of history is a thrilling story. We now have a clearer understanding of the manners and customs of the Hebrew people of Bible days and those of other nations living in the Bible lands. This knowledge is a great asset in the study of the Scriptures. It brings new light on the meaning of many Bible passages and confirms its divine authorship. This is not to be taken as proof of the verbal inerrancy of the various translations of the Holy Scriptures in common use today, but rather it indicates that historical skepticism is quite unwarranted. Since archaeology may be a relatively new subject to some of you, I will give a brief analysis of the discipline of archaeology. First, just what is archaeology? Archaeology is the science of antiquities, or the study of the relics of early races, in order to know or understand as much as possible about the life they lived. Biblical archaeology is basic archaeology, but a term applied to any research in Bible lands or to those discoveries that have a definite bearing upon the Scriptures. Second, what is an archaeologist? This is a little more complicated. You could say he is a scientist, a ditch digger, and a detective. A scientist because he must depend upon the sciences of chemistry and physics, architecture and engineering, linguistic and photography, and many others. A ditch digger because it is still the man with a shovel or trowel who is the most depended upon for the success of an archaeological dig. A detective because he must deduce from a few scattered clues what kind of people lived thousands of years ago, how they lived, what their tools and food and culture was like. What did they do for fun? Were they religious? And from old scrolls and shattered pottery, and from ruined buildings and temples, he must reconstruct a picture of the past, and then breathe life into it. He must take us traveling through time, so to speak, so we of the 20th century A.D. may know how men and women thought and felt thousands of years ago. Perhaps I should say a few words about history, which is the sister science to archaeology, because we will be dealing with the findings of research historians as well as archaeological findings in our studies. History is the record of the past. Ancient history is the early records and often the end products of centuries of oral transmission. Every human society has preserved some traditions of its past and to some extent explained itself in terms of the past. The earliest forms of history are generally found preserved in traditional lore. From one of the earliest writers, Herodotus, called the father of history, came perhaps the first unbiased inquiring studies of the affairs of men. However, the Bible and the writings of the ancient Greeks and Romans for centuries provided what seemed to be the beginning of human history. No earlier writings were known, and therefore nothing, it seemed, could be known about the remote past beyond what had been preserved by the ancient writers. Few realize how deeply we are indebted to the Bible for what we know of ancient history. The Bible is the only record of the ancient world that has remained available throughout the ages. Without it, ancient history would at one time have been a blank. The classical writers, the Greeks and Latin writers like Herodotus, do not go back beyond the 6th and 5th centuries B.C., and at that time the great civilizations of Egypt and Mesopotamia were already in their last stages. Many are surprised to learn that if it was not for the Bible, the science of archaeology might never have been born. What motivated the early explorers? Why did Bada, Layard, and others go looking for Nineveh, Babylon, and other lost cities? Because they read of them in the Bible. Nineveh is mentioned 20 times in the scriptures, and Babylon is mentioned 300 times or more. A little over 2 centuries ago, the science of archaeology emerged from man's finding and collecting curious objects of vanished societies to the development of large-scale excavations and the perfection of precise techniques in investigations. For many centuries, the dust of ages succeeded in burying the civilization of ancient Assyria. Previous to the year 1800, scholars could only guess as to the identity of certain mounds located in Assyrian territory. But the first half of the 19th century saw archaeologists digging in these mounds, and some very important discoveries were made before 50 years of the century had rolled by. One of the earliest, and perhaps the most important, insofar as shedding light on the Bible, was made by a young Englishman by the name of Austin Henry Layard. Excavating a mound on the west bank of the Tigris River, he discovered it to be the site of ancient Nineveh, the most famous capital of Assyria. In 2 small rooms, he found stores of clay tablets, inscribed all over with curious Assyrian arrowhead writings, which we now call cuneiform. Later, his assistant, Mr. Rassam, found another cache of these tablets. When scholars found out how to read the inscriptions on them, it was discovered that these stores of clay tablets were really the books of the great royal library of the Assyrian kings. Most had been gathered by some of the later Assyrian monarchs, especially by one called Ashurbanipal, the son of Esarhaddon, the last of the powerful Assyrian kings. The inscriptions showed that they had been arranged according to their subjects in different positions in the library. Each series had a title, being composed generally of the first words of the tablet. Usually at the end of each tablet, its number in the series was given. The writings included astronomical books with observations of the planets, astrological and magical texts, mathematical calculations, medical prescriptions, business documents, historical records of different reigns, and personal correspondence of the kings. Seemingly, every effort had been made to assemble literary works produced at times not necessarily connected with the era to which the library belonged, earning for itself the title A Congressional Library. The scribes of Ashurbanipal had searched the temples and schools of Babylonia and Assyria for these productions and rewrote them in what was then modern Assyrian. There are many indications of the transcription of older texts or the handing down from them from one period to another. Many have notations stating that they are copies written according to originals found in such and such a city. Several instances of earlier versions being copies have been found. For example, there is a version of the Gilgamesh, an ancient Babylonian ruler, legend which belongs to a period 1,500 years earlier than the library of Ashurbanipal. The same is true of the deluge story, which is represented by more ancient versions. Another tablet clearly shows it is a copy of a still older version. Not only is the name of the scribe who made the copy given, but where the original tablet was defective, he wrote, broken. Other libraries have been found at Nippur, Sippar, Larsa, Babylon, and Erech. The libraries of the first three sites belong chiefly to the 3rd millennium BC. Those of the last two belong to later periods. They are all primarily temple school libraries and contain also the tablets used by different priests in the temple services, such as hymns, prayers, and amens. Also dictionaries, grammatical exercises, and mathematical texts were found. Beside these libraries, immense archives of temple administrative documents belonging to all periods have been found in practically all the sites where excavations have been conducted. Other ancient mound cities have produced several hundred thousand documents belonging to the 3rd and 4th millennium BC. Many tablets record the payment into the temple stores of tithes and offerings, of drink, vegetables, or animals. Exhaustive accounts were kept of what was received and what was dispersed. Great storehouses have been excavated, which held the income. Over 100,000 tablets, dealing with legal and everyday business of the Assyrians and Babylonians, have been excavated. These documents are one of the most fruitful sources of light thrown upon the everyday life of the people. Not to mention the valuable historical and chronological data gathered from them. There are dowry, marriage contracts, partnership agreements, records of debts, promissory notes, leases of land, houses, slaves, deeds of transfer of all kinds of property and mortgages, documents dealing with the adoption of children, divorce, bankruptcy, inheritance, even the granting the power of attorney. The early translators of the tablets were amazed at the similarity between the everyday life of 2,500 years ago and the present day. In addition to the ancient books, numerous wall reliefs and inscriptions have been uncovered in the excavations of the Assyrian palaces. One Assyrian picture helped to explain an Old Testament word. In 2 Kings 7, verse 2, an officer of the king is referred to as being a lord on whose hand the king leaned. Verses 17 and 19 mention the same man. The American Standard Version translates captain instead of lord. This has led to much speculation as to the nature of this officer's task. The word Lord in Hebrew means, literally, the third. And some scholars suggest that the man was a third-ranking officer. However, a picture on the Assyrian palace wall has explained this Hebrew word. The carving is a representation of a war chariot, having three men in his crew. The driver, the man who did the fighting, and a third man who grasped the two straps that were attached to the back of the chariot, and thus made a living back for the vehicle. Standing at the back of the chariot, the third man would have prevented the driver or fighter from being thrown from the chariot as it traveled over bumpy ground. To be the third man in the king's chariot was a very responsible position. This man was, in truth, the third man on whose hand the king leaned. In a similar manner, an inscription of King Tiglath-Pileser III helps to clear up another scriptural reference, which some scholars thought referred to two different kings of Assyria. The verse in 1 Chronicles 5, verse 26 reads, "And God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, and he carried them away." The problem is with the word "he," used in the singular, and then, quote, "carried them away." However, the word "and" could be translated "even" in the Hebrew. Even so, the inscription went on to say that when the king received the land of Babylon as part of his domain, he was crowned as king of Babylonia and took the name of Pul or Pula. Thus we know that this Assyrian king had two names, Tiglath-Pileser III and a Babylonian name, Pul. The latter perhaps taken to convey to the Babylonians that they had their own king. The main interest of the Assyrian discoveries is the inscriptions and written contemporary records which throw light upon the history of Israel and makes the biblical narrative seem much more vivid. Bible scholars can now read details of the life of biblical characters and to understand the problems of their world as formerly one could not do. It is interesting to note that many tablets dealing with the matters of business or sometimes personal correspondence was kept private by encasing them in a thin layer of clay which served the purpose of envelope. On this cover would be the name of the individual addressed and the seal of the sender impressed on the back. In the case of commercial documents, contracts, bills, and inventories, the envelope served against forgery. Sometimes the contents were duplicated on the cover so they could be checked or a dispute be resolved without having to open the envelope. It comes as a surprise to students of ancient history to learn that in the days of Abraham, about 2000 B.C., the Babylonians had an extensive postal system with regular dispatches between many of its principal cities. This system was not only for the exclusive use of the governing authorities, but also for the general public. Evidence of this is from the thousands of clay cuneiform letters found in the excavated homes of the working classes. Letters with the addresses of the sender as well as the receiver, showing the distances traversed. From the Assyrian libraries, we learn that Assyria had cast a covetous eye upon Syria and the Mediterranean coastlands for many centuries before the final clash recorded in the Book of Kings. As early as the days of Saul, Tiglath-Pileser I had boasted of his raids on Phoenicia and Amorite land, as he called the north of Palestine. He recorded a human touch to one of his records. Quote, "He went deep sea fishing in the great sea of the setting sun." Obviously a reference to the Mediterranean Sea. However, what we call the Assyrian period of Hebrew history began much later. Our first hint of it occurring in the inscriptions of Ashur-Nazirpal in the days of Ahab, king of Israel. The Assyrian king wrote, "To the great sea of the land of the Amorites I went up, and wash the blood from my weapons in the great sea. The tribute of the kings of the sea coast of Tyre, Sidon, Gebal, the Amorites, and Arvad I received. This was written in 874 B.C., and this was prior to his involvement in the end of the complete destruction of Damascus and Samaria. It is significant that from this time forward, the kingdoms of Israel is given the distinctive name of its own in the Assyrian records, the land of Omri. 20 years later, in 835 B.C., war activity starts in earnest. An inscription reveals an important fact about Ahab, king of Israel, which had been omitted from the biblical narrative. For Shalmaneser III tells of a great battle at Karkar in 853 B.C., in which Ben-Hadad of Damascus and Ahab the Israelite, together with 12 other kings, were defeated by the Assyrians. The inscription reads, "I rained destruction upon them. I scattered their corpse far and wide. The plain was too small to let their bodies fall." That last was a little stretching of the truth. So Ahab, king of Israel, is actually the first Hebrew monarch to have his doings recorded outside the Bible, and the first to feel the cruel hand of the Syrians. Ahab made an alliance with Syria, which had a poor chance against the vast and warlike empire of Assyria. Shalmaneser also recorded another victory over Ben-Hadad of Damascus and his 12 friends in 848 B.C. Then in a brief notice of 842 B.C., we read how Ben-Hadad died and Hazael, the son of a nobody, seized the throne. Hazael is mentioned in 2 Kings verse 8. It can be seen at once how invaluable these inscriptions are, for not only confirming the biblical records, but fixing the exact dates of biblical history. Shalmaneser's campaign was not as decisive as he would have us to believe, for the inscriptions themselves record further trouble with the same Hazael in 838 B.C. Then for a whole generation, 40 years, we hear no more of Assyrian raids upon the land of Omri. The long years of peace was only the calm before the storm. In 805 B.C., another Assyrian king, Adad-nirari III, successfully invaded Amorite land, Tyre, Sidon, the land of Omri, Edom, Philistia, and Syria. The king of Damascus, Ben-Hadad III, was blockaded in his capital and compelled to surrender. A further invasion of Damascus in 773 B.C. is also briefly recorded. However blind the politicians of the time may have been to the gathering war clouds, there was one man, Amos the prophet, who foresaw very clearly the ultimate fate of those who opposed Assyria. The world plague and the total eclipse, which he interpreted as divine warnings, are actually mentioned under their respective dates in the Assyrian Limmu list or calendar. With the help of modern astronomy and these ancient inscriptions, we can date to the very day the eclipse, which terrified Amos so many centuries ago, occurred. You can find this story in Amos 8, verses 9. It happened on June the 15th, 763 B.C., Neither Amos nor Hosea, though they had foretold what was coming, lived long enough to see their prophecies fulfilled. It was not till 738 B.C. that, as 2 Kings 25, verse 19 describes it, quote, "that there came against the land Pul the king of Assyria, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver. So the king of Assyria turned back." The inscriptions go on to speak of several neighboring kings who escaped the Assyrians' wrath by prompt payment of tribute, one being Rezin, king of Damascus, famous in the Bible story. Rezin's name came up in another inscription. Tilat Pileser's own contemporary account of the fall of Damascus in 734 B.C. He wrote, "Rezin of Damascus fled alone to save his life. Like a mouse, he entered the gate of his city. His nobles I captured alive with my own hands and impaled them on stakes and let his land gaze upon them. His royal palace where he was born I besieged, I captured. 16 districts of Syria I destroyed like mounds left by a flood." 2 Kings 16, verse 9, describes the capture of the city and the slaying of Rezin. Probably no inscriptions in the world are so full of cruel and bloodthirsty details as those of the ancient Assyrians at every period of their history. The evidence of the written word more than confirms impressions of those sadistic carvings and pictures, showing the defeated enemies of Nineveh being flayed alive, their skins spread over ruined walls or impaled alive to die on stakes placed around the city for all to behold, or walled up alive, or buried alive beneath a pyramid of decapitated heads. Those who were fortunate enough to be spared the supreme penalty had their hands, noses, or ears cut off, or their eyes put out, or suffered some other inhuman form of mutilation. Unpleasant details, but they help us to realize what must have been the terror of Hezekiah when Sennacherib appeared before the walls of Jerusalem, and what must have been his courage in defying so ruthless a foe. Some scholars suggest, however, it was actually fear of what would happen to him if he surrendered. After Damascus was destroyed, Tilath-Pileser began to plan the conquest of Palestine, starting with the small but well-defended fortress of Samaria, the capital of the northern house of Israel. His inscriptions provide details of this conquest and corrects uncertain meanings of a passage in the biblical narrative of 2 Kings 17, verses 3 and 6. It seemed that although the siege of Samaria was begun by Shalmaneser V, actually it was not he but his successor, Sargon, who finally reduced the city in 722 B.C. The discovery of the existence of the Assyrian king Sargon was one of the most important discoveries made by the archaeologists, excavating the Assyrian city of Khorsabad. The name Sargon occurs only once in the Bible, Isaiah 20, verse 1, and Bible scholars had assumed it to be an alternate for Shalmaneser V. However, he is now known to have been one of the most important kings in Assyria, leaving behind him a voluminous record of military and political triumphs. Among the records, we read of his first conquest of Samaria. Quote, "In the first year of my reign, the people of Samaria, to the number of 27,290 of its inhabitants, I carried away. The city I rebuilt. People of the lands I conquered, I settled therein. My official I set over them as governor and reckoned them as people of Assyria itself." This came from the Nimrud prism, number 4, part of columns 25 and 41. Sargon little realized what he had done, or that his destruction of Israel was the fulfillment of Bible prophecy, and would be remembered by countless millions long after all his other successes, even his very name, had been buried in oblivion. What was the ultimate fate of the 10 tribes of Israel, known as the Kingdom or House of Israel, that was carried away into Assyrian captivity between 745 and 721 B.C.? There are perhaps hundreds of thousands of persons who have never given the slightest study, perhaps not even a passing thought, as to what happened to them. If they were asked the question, they would probably say, "Didn't they just amalgamate with the Assyrians during their captivity and thus lose their identity forever?" Or they might say, "Were they not included among the Jews after their return from captivity in Babylon?" Both answers are wrong. The scriptures speak of a future restoration of Israel, which would also include the house of Judah. The chief rabbi of the Jewish church in England, when asked, was it true that the 10 tribes of Israel, originally taken captive to Assyria, were not with the remnant of Judah from Babylon? Answered, you are right in surmising that the 10 tribes did not return to the Holy Land. The Jewish Quarterly Review of July 1903 stated, of the Israelites, meaning the kingdom or house of Israel, nothing authentic is known after their departure from Palestine to Halah, Habar, by the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Medes. With the beginning of their captivity, they seem to have passed from all human knowledge. Isaac Leister, in the Jewish Religion, Volume 1, page 256, wrote, by the return of the captivity from Babylon, the Israelitish nation was not restored, since the 10 tribes who had formerly comprised the kingdom of Israel were yet left in banishment, and to this day the researchers and travelers and wise men have not been able to trace them. So we find the Jewish scholars do not have the answer to our question. However, the scriptures give us a clue, according to 2 Ezra chapter 13, verse 40. The 10 tribes which were carried away prisoners out of their own land in the time of Hosea the king, whom Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, led away captive, and he carried them over the waters, so they came into another land. But they took counsel among themselves that they would leave the multitude of the heathen and go forth into a further country where never mankind dwelt, that they might keep their statutes, which they never kept in their own land. And they entered into Euphrates by the narrow passages of the river. For the Most High then showed signs for them, and held the flood till they were passed over. For through that country there was a great way to go, namely of a year and a half, and the same region is called Arsareth. From this passage, we know that the 10 tribes did not remain in Assyria and did not return to Palestine after the Babylonian captivity. Also, Hosea the prophet, in chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, tells us that the house of Israel, after her captivity and losing her name as God's people Israel, were to be eventually restored to favor. Reading, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it is said unto them, ye are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. Thus the scriptures show that Israel did not remain in Assyrian captivity. Ezekiel 5, verses 5 to 7, prophesies the destruction of Judah, which was fulfilled in A.D. 70. When the Romans destroyed Jerusalem. Further Bible confirmation that the house of Israel is in existence is found in Jeremiah 35, verse 36, which reads, thus saith the Lord, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon, and of the stars for a light by night, which divideth, that meaneth stilleth, the sea when the waves thereof roar. The Lord is his name. If these ordinances, that is the sun, moon, and stars, depart from before me, saith the Lord, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me forever. This passage distinctly declares that as long as the sun, moon, and stars exist, the nation of Israel will remain a nation. Unless God's promises have failed, Israel must be in existence today. So the question is, where is the 10-tribe house of Israel today? What nation on earth represents them? How can they be discovered? One is Bible prophecy, which declares that Israel exists as a multitudinous nation, bearing certain marks, inheriting certain blessings, doing certain things for which it was created, and having a divine mission and destiny to perform. That they were to be restored is found in Jeremiah 31, verse 10. Hear the word of the Lord, O ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, he that scattered Israel will gather him, and keep him as a shepherd doth his flock. Then Ezekiel 28, verse 34, I will bring you out from the people, and will gather you out of the countries wherein ye are scattered, with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm, the fury poured out. Although Israel was to be scattered among the heathen, Jeremiah 33, verse 17, tells of their restoration. I will restore health unto thee, and I will heal thee of thy wounds, saith the Lord, because they called thee an outcast. Isaiah 56, verse 8 reads, The Lord God which gathereth the outcasts of Israel saith, Yet will I gather others to him, beside those that are gathered unto him. There are many other passages in Scripture telling the same story, the future restoration of the kingdom of Israel. For any sincere student of the Bible, willing to examine all the scriptural evidence, the conclusion that the so-called lost tribes of Israel must be in existence today is incontestable. So we are back to the question, what happened, or rather, where are the lost tribes today? Meaning the northern kingdom of Israel, together with a large number of the kingdom of Judah, who were exiled between 750 and 721 B.C. Seemingly, the question of what happened to the Israelites can only be answered by the Assyrians, who took the Israelites captive. But they and their empire have long since passed away. However, the Assyrians did leave many records of their conquests, including the subjection and deportation of Israel to Assyria and where they were settled. These records, in the form of wall inscriptions and clay cuneiform tablets, verify the Bible records of Israel's captivity. But most important, they also recorded the sojourn and escape of the Israelites from captivity. These records were only discovered in 1850 in the form of cuneiform tablets found in the excavations of the Assyrian Royal Library of Ashurbanipal at Nineveh. Later, these were translated by Professor Waterman of the University of Michigan. The translations were published in 1930, but their relevance to Israel was missed at the time. This was undoubtedly because they were in complete disorder and among hundreds of miscellaneous texts dealing with many matters of state. Contributing to this situation was the fact that the Assyrians called the Israelites by other names during their captivity. Of the over 20,000 tablets found, 1,470 consisted of correspondence of the kings and are known as the Royal Correspondence of the Assyrian Empire. Of these, some 20 tablets have been found dealing with the Israelites in captivity, their activities, and escape from captivity. Bear with me as I give details on some of these tablets, because they are important in answering our question as to the identification of the lost tribes of Israel today. The cuneiform tablets were reports dated around 707 B.C. sent from spies operating on the borders between Assyria and Urartu to the Assyrian king. The spies were evidently sent there to keep watch and report Urartian activities. One tablet, known as Letter 123, Ashur-Esura to King Sargon, reads in part, In regards to the orders which the king my lord issued to me concerning the watch of the people of the land of Urartu, the people of the land of Urartus have not gone forth from the city of Tereshpa. Another tablet, identified as Letter 4920, Ashur-Esura to King Sargon, reported military activities by the Urartuans against the fortress city of Usesi and Elizada. Another tablet, Letter 444, from the same spy, confirmed the capture of Usesi and the city of Tereshpa. Yet another tablet, Letter 1079, Sennacherib to King Sargon. Now this was a letter from Sargon's son, Sennacherib, forwarding information he had received of an Urartuan defeat and indicating that he would continue to gather details and send a further report. what appears to be his follow-up communication, letter 197, Sennacherib to King Sargon, reads in part, "When the king of the people of Urartu went into the land of Gamir, his army met with a debacle. He and his district commanders, with their contingents, have been hurled back. A great slaughter has taken place among them." The name Gamir is evidently a corruption of the name Gomri or Qumri, a name used by Sargon II in 722 to 705 BC when he invaded and removed the northern tribes of Israel to Assyria. The word Qumri was the Assyrian name for Omri, the royal family ruling Israel at that time. The Hebrew name Omri begins with the consonant Y called Ayin, which is pronounced with a guttural H, and is represented in Assyrian transliteration as G or K. In his annals or records, the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser III, that is King Pul of the Bible, also used the name Qumri in his records of the deportation of the Israelites to Assyria. Letter 197 also identified the area of the disastrous rout of the Urartuans as the land of Gamir. Since this area was southeasterly from Urartu, this would place it in the territory of the Mania, south of Lake Urmia, which was the location where many of the exiled Israelites had been placed only 14 years earlier. For self-preservation, the Israelites would have resisted the intrusion of the Urartuans. This was the primary reason the Assyrians settled captive peoples on their borders, to act as a buffer against any foreign invaders. Several tablets reveal the name of the inhabitants of Gamir as Gamirriah, translated Cimmerians by Professor Waterman. An example is found in letter 112, Arad Sin, to the overseer of the palace. It reads in part, "The Gamirriah, or Cimmerians, went forth from the midst of the Mania, and into the land of Urartus they entered. Plunder he has taken." This is only one of several letters that shows the Israelites known as Gemira or Cimmerians, although occupying part of the land of the Medes and the Mania, were a distinct people. Further confirmation that the Gemira were a distinct people from the inhabitants of the area can be seen in a series of tablets found at Nineveh, in which the king of Assyria, Esarhaddon, is reciting prayers to the sun god Shamash. The king is asking for divine guidance about the operation of his troops sent to collect tribute in the territory of the Medes and the Mania. Several texts mention hostile bands of Gemira, another spelling for Gemira, both among the Medes and the Mania. Additional proof that the Gemira were strangers to the area is found in an account of Esarhaddon dealing with the battle with the Gemira, or Cimmerians, as Professor Waterman identifies them. In the second year of his reign, he wrote, "To Espa the Cimmerian, a barbarian whose land is afar off, I cut down with the sword in the land of Hubushna, together with all his troops." The expression, "whose home is afar off," could be based on the knowledge that the Cimmerians, or Gemira, were in fact exiles from their native land. It is significant that Professor Waterman, in translating the Assyrian word Gamirriah to Cimmerian, came very close to recognizing the connection between the Cimmerians and the lost tribes of Israel. His failure to do so was because he made the mistake of believing the name Cimmerian was derived from Gomer, the son of Japheth. Apparently, he accepted that interpretation that had been advanced in 1885 by Professor Rawlison, a noted British scholar, and whose works he considered unnecessary for reexamination. In checking Rawlison's works, it is noted that he in turn accepted that interpretation from Josephus, who first gave this meaning to the world. Rawlison, like many other scholars, trusted to Josephus's guidance and fell into this error. Perhaps I should point out here, the Celts of Western Europe in the British Isles are recognized by historians as being from the Cimmerians, who migrated into Europe and Britain from around the Black Sea several centuries before Christ. But to continue our study, another spy report, letter 1237, Belusazib to King Esarhaddon, refers to the Gemira as offsprings of outcasts. Again, this suggests they were strangers from another land. The report went on to advise the king that his troops, being sent to collect tribute from the Mania, should move with caution because of the Gemira. The report reads in part, "Enter into the midst of the Mania, all the troops should not enter. Let the cavalry and the Daku invade the Gemira. They are the offspring of outcasts. They recognize neither the oath of a god nor a human agreement." Although Esarhaddon successfully put down the revolt of the Gemira under Tuespa, Assyrian records reported that a large number of the Gemira had escaped to the shores of the Black Sea, where they settled around Sinope. Later, two invasions into Lydia by the Gemira are reported. The second one resulting in the Gemira occupying Sardis, the capital of Lydia. Then about 600 BC, the Lydian king Alyetes drove the Gemira out of Asia Minor altogether. As the Gemira moved west into the Carpathian regions of South Russia, called in 2nd Esdras, or Sereth, or Mountains of Sereth, they were called by the Greeks Cimmerioi, translated Cimmerian in the English. The main bodies of Gemira that did not escape the Assyrians accepted an alliance with Esarhaddon when he came under attack by both the Medes and the Babylonians. These Gemira were allowed to establish colonies in Sakasini in the northern part of the Assyrian Empire and in Bactria in the eastern portion of the empire. Both colonies are described by the Greek historians as Scythians. The Greeks, however, failed to identify the Scythians as Israelites. It had been well over 100 years since the Israelites had been exiled into Assyria, during which time their identity lost, or at least their name was changed, and in time they forgot their identity. After the fall of the Assyrian Empire in 612 BC, when they became under attack by the Babylonians, the Gemara Israelites, now known as Scythians, that had settled in the Sakasini, crossed the Araxes River, migrating north through the Dariel Pass in the Caucasus Mountains. They occupied the steppe regions of South Russia. The other branch of Gemara Israelites, also known as Scythians, that had colonized Bactria, retreated across the Gerardus River to become known by the Persians by the name Saka or Sakai and Massagetai. Another Israelite-Scythian archaeological link is found on the side of a hill in northern Persia, now Iran, along the old caravan road between Ecbatan and Babylon. It is in the form of inscribed writings on a rock face some 300 feet above the base of the hill. It is known as the Behistun Rock. This inscription by Darius the Great boasts of having taken some Saka as prisoners about 500 BC. The trilingual inscription is carved in Akkadian, Elamite, and Old Persian. Where the name Gemara appears in the Babylonian text, the word Saka appears in the Persian text. Ancient historians tell us that the later people whom the Greeks called Scythians in their histories were originally called Saka or Sakai by the Persians. To continue to trace the Scythian Israelites, during the 6th century BC, they overran the whole of Ukraine as far as the Carpathian Mountains. Their kinship lost during their long separation, the Scythians fought and drove the Cimmerians, who had settled there earlier, westward, where they became known as Celts and Gauls. For 200 years, the great and prosperous Scythian kingdom had close relationships with the Greeks, to whom they supplied grain and precious metals. However, toward the end of the 4th century BC, a non-Israelite people known as the Sarmatians invaded the Scythian kingdom from the east. After many battles, the Scythians were in turn driven out of the area. Squeezed between Sarmatians and the Celts, now occupying Central Europe, the Scythians were forced to move northwest, where they are later reported by the Romans as settling around the south coast of the Baltic and the North Sea. As the Sarmatian tribes moved into Scythia in South Russia, there was a tendency to confuse them with the Scythians, as people were often called by the name of the land they lived in. But the Romans solved that problem by introducing the name German for the genuine Scythians, Germanus or Germani being the Latin name for genuine. Roman historians soon dropped the name Scythian in favor of Germans, not to be confused with the modern Germans, descendants of only a small portion of the Germanic tribes. It is a fact of modern history that during the succeeding centuries, the Celtic Israelites spread out over Central Europe, while the Scythian Israelites broke up into many divisions. The Goths, Angles, Saxons, Jutes, Danes, and Vikings, just to name a few. Then, as the Celtic tribes moved on into Britain to form the bedrock of the British race, other Germanic tribes poured into the vacated lands in the south to form the Gothic nations of the Vandals, Lombards, Franks, Burgundians, Visigoths, and Ostrogoths. Between AD 450 and 600, some of the Angles and Saxons moved into Britain as Anglo-Saxons. Between AD 850 and 1000, the Danes and Vikings raided the coasts of Britain, establishing colonies, while others settled in Iceland and Greenland. One group moved into France as Normans, known as Northmen, and some, later in 1066, moved into Britain to become a part of the British race. The Celts, who had originally settled in Ireland, moved into northern Britain and established the nation of the Scots, while some settled in northern Wales, the Isle of Man, and the Scilly Islands. Ireland later became settled by Danes, Vikings, Huguenots from France, even Moors from Spain. It is noteworthy that the Scots, in their Scottish Declaration of Independence, drawn up in AD 1320, treat themselves as being of Israel, having come from Scythia, which includes Arcareth, and significantly date their history from the, quote, outgoing of the people of Israel, obviously from Egypt, a reference to the Exodus. In this short study, I have not attempted to relate all the details of the movements of the people known as Cimmerians and Scythians. This information can be found in public libraries with detailed maps produced by archaeologists and historians. The origin of the Cimmerians and Scythians, who form the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Germanic, Lombardic, and Celtic nations, however, has not been known with certainty until now. The prevailing theory has been that these people originated in southern Russia, north of Caucasus. But the earliest Scythian remains or artifacts found there are none earlier than 580 BC, whereas in recent years, Scythian tombs have been found south of the Caucasus, producing dates from before 700 BC. Thanks to the cuneiform records of the Assyrians, archaeology has solved two great mysteries, both occurring at the same time in history. First, where did the countless thousands of Scythians and countless thousands of Cimmerians come from? Second, what happened to the countless thousands of Israelites who disappeared into Assyrian captivity about the same time in history? Both mysteries no longer exist. The so-called lost tribes of Israel were really never lost. They only lost their identity as they migrated westward over the centuries as Cimmerians and Scythians. First, they settled in Western Europe and the Isles in the West. Later, many migrated to America, the land in the wilderness. In all their migrations, they were, as prophesied in the Bible, concerning the kingdom or house of Israel, blind to their identity. The God of our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, kept his promise in Jeremiah 31, verse 10, where he said, "Hear the word of the Lord, O you nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, He that scattered Israel will gather him and keep him, as a shepherd doth his flock." Identifying lost Israel reveals the fulfillment of another prophecy concerning the Israelites. 2 Samuel 7, verse 10 reads, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time." Well, since the Israelites were in Palestine at the time of that prophecy, it follows that the appointed place had to be somewhere else. America, peopled by a gathering from all the Israel nations or tribes, could be that appointed land, and the home of regathered Israel. It is a matter of inspired record that God placed marks on his people Israel. It follows that if we can discover the nations possessing these marks, we have found the people whom God chose to serve him to be a channel of blessing to all mankind. Israel to be a great and mighty nation, to have a multitude of seed, as the stars in the heavens and the sand on the shores, to colonize and spread abroad to the west, east, north, and south, to have a new home northwest of Palestine, to colonize, then expand, demanding more room, to have a new name and language, to become a nation and a company of nations, to lose all trace of her lineage, to be kind to the poor and set slaves free, to lend to other nations and borrow from none, to be a land of great mineral and agricultural wealth, to be called the sons of God and accept Christianity, to become the custodians of the oracles of God, that is the scriptures, to carry the gospel to all the world. These are only a few of the marks of Israel, marks only carried today by the Caucasian peoples of Western Europe, the British Isles, and United States. The complete story of Israel's captivity and migrations is available in book form. The missing links discovered in Assyrian tablets. Write for book list and prices.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.